It is my great pleasure to introduce, and I think he needs very little introduction to most people taking part in today's session, Professor Stephen Downe from Canada. He's a senior researcher at the Institute for Information Technology's Senior Learning Group in Canada's National Research Council. But for many of us, of course, he's much better known because of OLJ, and the very stimulating and interesting and provocative insights he has given to many of us interested in the area of technology enhanced learning, particularly in recent years. So Stephen, it's over to you, and if I could ask you to still forget to set off your slides as you're in, because we need you to set those off at the beginning of your slides. So Stephen Downe, over to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for the kind introduction, and hello to everybody all around Europe. It's a pleasure to be talking with you this afternoon. It's just after 1 p.m. my time, so it's a bit earlier in the day for me than it is for you. I'll be talking on the topic of Knowledge 2.0 toward a future knowledge society, and I was given a very wide topic to address today. Not simply the topic of knowledge in itself, but how knowledge, how our conception of knowledge will impact learning, how our conception of knowledge will impact society. I'm going to focus mostly on the knowledge parts, although you'll see bits and pieces of the learning and society aspects seeded throughout this discussion. We begin not so long ago at a time when everything was in order. I mean, we thought we knew what knowledge was. Knowledge was something like justified true belief. And we taught everybody that we have two very specific types of knowledge. On the one hand, we had universal knowledge. Things like laws of nature, general principles, mathematical and logical theorems. These expressed truths that were timeless, that would never change. They expressed generalities. And on the other hand, we had particulars, concrete particulars. These would be specific instances of the generalizations that we had previously. So we would describe things like circumstances, or instances of a general phenomenon, or instances of a category, or applications of a rule, or of a general principle. It was, as they say, the good old HD model, the hypothetical deductive model created by and fostered by the logical positivists, including people like Carl Hempel. The logical positivist model, the model of science as we all knew it, was based on a very standard formula, based on observations, then generalizations from those observations, prediction of consequences based on those generalizations, and then verification of the principle, or if you're Karl Popper, falsification of the principle. The world, we thought, was a totality of facts, not things. The world was something that we could describe, that we would use language to describe, that we would have instances, we would have entities, and those entities would have properties, and these entities and these properties would be formulated in a language that was governed by the principles of logic and mathematics. And that was our picture of knowledge. That's what we thought knowledge was. Well, since then, it has all fallen apart. Sorry? There we go. It has all fallen apart. Our nice, wonderful picture of order and prediction and causality has, since the time of the fall of the logical positivist worldview, crumbled into something quite different. The fall came from two major sources. One would be Willard Van Orman Quine's two dogmas of empiricism. One dogma being the nice, sharp separation that we can draw between statements about general truths, analytic statements, and statements about synthetics, about particular synthetic statements. And the other principle of reductionism, the idea that all of our knowledge, all of our theories, reduced in the end to observations, to concrete particulars, to statements of fact. The other thing that caused the end of our wonderful worldview was Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where when we look at through history the development of science, we don't see fact upon fact accumulating into this huge pile of knowledge, but rather shifts, radical shifts between worldviews. These came to be known as paradigm shifts. Shifts that were so dramatic, so radical, that the sentences, the language used in one worldview was quite literally not understood in another worldview. But how could this be if universal principles were universal? What I'm trying to get at here is that when we talk about knowledge and we talk about the new types of knowledge of connectionism and connectivism, this is not something that just started with the internet. This is a shift in our understanding of knowledge that has been going on for some time. In the words of Billy Joel, we didn't start the fire. It has always been burning since the world's been turning. That's the social part of the talk. Enter into this picture the network, the idea that everything is connected to everything else. This first shows up in the philosophy of science and in the philosophy of knowledge as the assertion or the description of theory-laden data, the idea that the very words that we use to describe the observations are themselves based on our prior knowledge, our prior beliefs or models about the nature of the world. Enter the network again, in the sense that our nice, neat predictions using cause and effect and general principles seem to break down, and they break down in just the really important areas that we need to concentrate on. It's not just that we can't predict the weather, although we can't predict the weather, but neither can we predict major social trends. Things like the stock market, for example, have been notoriously difficult to predict. Or movements in societies. All of this is traced or described under the headings of chaos theory, where even small variations in the description of initial conditions can lead to radical, almost random differences in outcomes later on. Enter the network. It's a breakdown of order, and it's not just the breakdown of order that we see through the 60s and 70s, as described by Billy Joel, although it's part of that. It's not just postmodernism. It's not just ethnocentricity. It's the sorts of things that we have been seeing in what has been called internet culture recently. Things like the Kutrain Manifesto, things like We the Media, where the nice order that we have in society, the nice order that we have in knowledge and knowledge management is breaking down, where, as they say in Kutrain, markets are conversations, business is a conversation, the customer co-creates with the producer. This is not the nice, ordered, structured world that we used to know. Oops. This is me struggling with Windows. Now, into this picture, surprisingly almost, rides the concept of knowledge management. And this is the way the whole internet was going to be, right? This is the picture that we were, I won't say promised, although we were promised, where we would use our technologies and capture tacit knowledge. We would capture the knowledge of workers, the knowledge of experts, of subject matter experts. We'd capture it in process, and then we'd codify it. We'd put it into concrete instances of knowledge, knowledge objects, say, or learning objects. The whole idea here being to take the fuzzy, difficult to work with everyday knowledge that everyone has and make it concrete and make it solid. To make it like that old picture, right? To make it like that old kind of knowledge, that hypothetical kind of deductive knowledge.
Stephen, can I just interrupt you just for a moment?
Yes.
After you find it, you don't need to switch off the slides all the time. That's okay if you're having to do that. Okay?
Okay. I'm just trying to vary it up to make it interesting.
Okay. It's really interesting. Beautiful.
Okay, thank you. This is no trouble at all, really. That's okay. You can see the picture here on this slide, right? You can see that standard will take the shareable content objects, will grind them together in this nice predictable machine and shoot them out into learners' brains. Because that old picture of knowledge that we had extended to learning, where if knowledge is a totality of facts, then learning is the accumulation of those facts. And so that was the model that we got. But you can't go back again. You can't get there from here. Once the knowledge is in somebody's head, once it's all mushy and non-particular and difficult to work with, you can't break it out and put it in the box anymore. The whole theory, well, I won't say theory, but the development of knowledge management, if you look in the papers describing it, a lot of that goes to Michael Polanyi. But if you look at Michael Polanyi, he describes two major things: personal knowledge, the name of his book, and tacit knowledge. And very roughly, we can say two things about this kind of knowledge. First of all, that it depends on context. Oh, I see I've got my things backwards. Oh well. It depends on context. You can't generalize it. And secondly, tacit knowledge is ineffable. You can't put it into words. It is, as Polanyi said, like the knowledge of how to ride on a bicycle. You could sit there and describe how to ride a bicycle all day, all night, all week, and yet at the end of it, you still would not know how to ride a bicycle. You would not have learned how to ride a bicycle. What is this new knowledge? Well, in this new picture, this new knowledge is like patterns in the mesh. The knowledge is in the network. The old way, the old type of knowledge that we had, the knowledge consisted of universals, of rules, categories, generalizations. The new type of knowledge that we have, the knowledge consists of patterns. Patterns and similarities in the network. Indeed, it's safe to say the knowledge is the network. The knowledge is the shape of the network, the connections in the network. Here's what it looks like, more or less. We have the network on the one hand, and we have the thing that the network is describing on the other hand. Here we have the concept of a tree embedded in the network. And the thing to notice is that there is no specific thing inside the network that stands for a tree. There's certainly no word, tree. There's no single concept, tree. Rather, the concept of the tree is distributed through the network. It is a pattern of connectivity. What makes this very interesting is that the same network can encode multiple patterns. It can encode multiple descriptions. I'm being flagged by somebody. What is it? Oh, and the door is locked. There's somebody at my door waving at me, and then the door is locked so he can't get in. So I'll keep talking while he comes in. And I have no idea what it is. Maybe the building's on fire.
There's no need to switch in between the two. Even if they just call me and tell me there's no need to switch in between the two images, they can see both your images over there.
Oh, they can?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I didn't know that.
Whatever you're doing, it's all set up perfectly now. All you have to do is...
Okay. Perfect. Thank you. I'm being told, don't mess with the machine. Everything is working. Okay. Fine. That's what I get for trying to be creative. Anyhow, all right. Never mind. The important thing here, the interesting thing, at least to me, is you can have multiple concepts represented inside a single network. So you have the tree and the puppy dog and the couch all in the same network. That means you can see my hand gestures too. That's good because I like my hand gestures. I need my hand gestures. So, interestingly, the concept of tree is related to the concept of puppy dog, is related to the concept of couch, even though semantically they have nothing to do with each other. Because they are all represented in the same physical network, a change to one of those concepts impacts the other concepts. the theory. Concepts are not words. They are patterns in a network. A network like the mind. A network like society. There is no specific place that the concept is located. The concept is distributed as a set of connections across the network. Other concepts are embedded in the same network. They form parts of each other. They affect each other. These connections, these patterns, can self-organize. They can form patterns themselves simply through the nature of the network. These connections, these patterns, reflect the properties of the things being connected. Here we have atoms being connected to each other, and as you can see, the patterns that they form are based on the nature of the atoms, and this is true in general of connections. These connections obey the laws of physics. Nothing magical to them. Here we have the distribution of force in a trellis structure, and this occurs simply because of the way force and trellis structures work in nature. In general, and I'm generalizing here because I'm giving a 25-minute talk, there are three major types of organization of patterns in a network. There's Hebbian associationism, which is based on the concurrent firing or not firing of individual entities in the network. There's backpropagation, in other words, a mechanism for correcting the output of a network. And then thirdly, there's Boltzmann pattern creation, based on the settling properties or the annealing properties of a network. If you think about you drop a rock into a pond, you get ripples, and then eventually the ripples settle out. This kind of settling is the sort of thing that a Boltzmann pattern creation mechanism would produce. Now that's patterns. That's the global view, what it looks like, you know, from 30,000 feet. But, you know, sitting here talking about patterns isn't going to be that useful at the concrete level. It's not going to be that useful when you sit down and you try to build a system that'll help people learn, or you try to design a training program. So we need also to know what the network looks like when you're actually in the network, when you're actually embedded in there. Well, there's the easy answer. The easy answer is the hand-waving answer. You get this a lot. The easy answer is it looks like the internet. It looks like open source. It looks like social networks. It looks like blogs and blogging and wikis and all of that stuff. It looks like Web 2.0. But underneath the easy answer is a set of harder answers. And we've all had a lot of fun recently with the U.S. Senator who described the internet as a set of tubes. But you know, when you think of the internet as a set of tubes, you begin to sort of see the picture a little bit. And we look for the connections in the network, and we look for the interactions in the network. And more concretely, what that looks like is XML. What that looks like is the APIs that join one program with another program. It's about the links that join one thing to another. And that's something that I'll just say as an aside, that the designers of learning object metadata almost completely forgot. Learning object metadata describes, but we don't see so much how it links. And then there's the complex answer. And this is probably best approached by giving an example. And the example I'll give is of recommender systems. We ask, how do you know that this thing, this book, or this piece of music, or this learning resource, will be good? Well, it used to be, the old way, we would match it against a set of criteria. We would match it against some ideal, universal standard of goodness. But in recommender systems, we say the following. We say, in the past, people like you expressed satisfaction with things like this. In this kind of system, there are no principles or rules describing quality. It's almost random. It's just people say, oh, I like this. It's only individual preferences.
There's no rubric. There's no metric. There's no peers or committees of experts. The evaluations even are not an aggregation. There's no votes. There's no overall determination. This is good. This is bad. It always depends on the very particular context, the very particular person who is looking at the resource. If you look at that recommender system, what you see is you see three major types of data being connected. And in this case in particular, we have user profiles, we have evaluations, and we have resource profiles. What we have inside the pipes, if you will, are complex answers that link different types of data together. Each type of data, data describing a resource, data describing a person, is a feature set. Users, for example, might be described in friend of a friend metadata, which describes the individual features of a particular person. A resource might be described in learning object metadata, or it might be described in RSS. Evaluations might be, we don't even have a format yet for evaluations. A lot of this stuff is still to come. It's still in the future. But the point is through the use of these feature sets that we measure similarity. The similarity that allows us to compare one thing to another. Which features do we use? That depends on salience. That depends on how important a certain feature is to you right now. If you're driving a car, the most important property of the car might be how much gas it has, because you might be going a long way. Or it might be how fast the car goes, because you're racing somebody. The importance of the feature depends on the particular context. Resource profiles is one type of this data, and it's one that I've looked at in some detail. If we look at how we want to describe a resource in terms of the different features or properties it might have, we find that we want to have multiple vocabularies because different types of resources have different types of features. A video, for example, will have as a property duration, but a photograph will not. We also want descriptions of resources from multiple authors. Right now, in things like learning object metadata, we get descriptions almost entirely by the producer of the object. But we also want descriptions authored by the users of objects. We want descriptions authored by other people who are evaluating objects. And then finally, in resource profiles, we find that we want these descriptions to be in different places, to be scattered. Part of the description in one location, part of the description in another location. This may sound all very complicated, but if you think about it, we already have such a system in place. It's the system that we use to describe people. Think about yourself. Think about the data that describes you. Where is that data located? Well, part of that data is in your wallet, right? You might have your identification number there. You certainly have your name there. Part of that data may be at the university that you graduated from. You'll have your grades and your courses and your grades. Part of that, depending on your history, part of that data may be at the police station. You might have a criminal record. Who knows? The hospital or your doctor may have different data. They will have medical information. And you get the idea, right? And the point is, as you go through life, you begin with very little data, but as time goes by, more and more data accumulates about you. And different people have different points of view, and all of this data is put together in different places. And what creates the profile of you, what creates a picture or a representation of you, is the bringing together of this data, the looking at this data as a whole. The three major types of metadata that I've characterized: first person or first party metadata, which is data created by the producer or the author of a resource. Second person or second party metadata, which is data created by the user or created through the process of use of a resource. and then third-party metadata, which is data created by some person who is neither the creator nor the user. And it might be an evaluation of the resource or a classification of the resource or whatever. So we ask, what will we see? What will be the impact of this sort of picture of knowledge? And we can see that we're going to go beyond recommendations, that we are going to use this kind of data network to create classifications, for example. We're already seeing that with tagging. To create valuation of resources. The stock market is a loose sort of way of doing this. Blog Shares is a site that you may have seen that has people value the qualities of different websites. There will be indeed new types of knowledge that we don't know about yet, that I can't describe yet, because they don't exist yet, based on the bringing together of these networks of information about different resources. Knowledge, in this picture again, is like recognition. Learning is like perception. It's the acquiring of these patterns that are formed through these networks of connections between entities through experience. It's pattern recognition, as William Gibson would say. And it's a phenomenon that we've seen already. It's a phenomenon that we know it when we see it. We know what it looks like, because when we're standing in a class, what we're actually aiming for is not the accumulation of facts in a person's brain, but, sorry about that, I bumped my slide. You're looking for that aha look. You're looking for the student to suddenly sort of go, oh yeah, I get it. And that's the snapping into place of a picture in or of a recognition in the student's mind. Knowledge is like recognition. It's a belief that you can't not have. It's a way of seeing the world. I don't know if you have Waldo in Europe. You must have Waldo in Europe. What Waldo is you stick Waldo, you can see him in the corner, you stick him in the picture there where he's hidden by all the detail in the picture. And then the whole idea is you're supposed to search through the picture and find where's Waldo. But the thing is, once you found Waldo, you can't not find him again. Once you see where he is, the recognition is snapped into place and it's no longer a mystery. Pattern recognition is based on similarity. It's based on similarity between the current phenomenon and previously recognized phenomenon. So what we want is we want our students to be able to recognize these patterns in existing networks. We want them to recognize patterns in communities of experts or communities of practice, in the work being done by these communities of experts. That's why we model to students. That's why we demonstrate to students. Now the question comes up, what kind of network works? What kind of network is going to produce reliable patterns, patterns that we can depend on? Because it should be clear that not just any network will do, that sometimes networks break down. Too little connection in the network, or you never get a pattern at all. That's just, it's nothing. It's like your TV is turned off. Too much connection, though, and information propagates through your network too quickly. It's like static. It's simply noise and no pattern. So we need to find that middle road there. We need to find some sort of description of a network that will be appropriate. The internet itself gives us at least something like a description. It gives us an example of the kind of network that can work. And in particular, when we look at the properties of the network, the properties of the internet, to try to find what kinds of networks will reliably produce and help us see these patterns, we look for networks that are decentralized, disaggregated, distributed, disintermediated, dynamic, desegregated, and possibly most important of all, democratic. And I wish I could go on and talk a long time about all of these principles, but obviously I can't. I do want to pause briefly on the democratic condition, because this is the semantic condition. This is the condition that allows us to trust networks. This is the condition that enables us to ensure that the knowledge that we get from networks will be reliable. Reliable networks support four major principles. They support the autonomy of their entities, they support diversity of the members of the network, openness of the network to communications from outside, and connectivity, a way for the entities in the network to communicate with each other. That is my talk as a whole. With every slide, I'm sure I could have lingered for half an hour, and I apologize for not doing that, but I also apologize for going a little bit over time. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Stephen. And a brilliant and very interesting, you've given us plenty of food for thought, I can tell you. What we're going to do now, as we agreed, is it's just coming up to 4 to 7 here in Europe. So we're going to take about a 5-minute break here in our local group, and then we'll take about 25 minutes to have our discussion. So we will be back with you at about 12-14 minutes past 7 our time. And we'll keep the lines open in case there's anything we need to talk to you urgently about. Other than that, we will go into our local discussion. Thank you very much so far. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, everybody. We're going to pick up our... what we're going to do, I hope you will see, here in Berlin, we've been having very lively discussion about networks and frameworks, and we'll tell you all about it in a few minutes. But to be as efficient as we can with the remaining 45 minutes that we have, I'm going to suggest that we do a short round through all of the different sites. And I'll ask you just to summarize what your main discussion has been about, and if you want to put even an initial question as well to Stephen. But Stephen, I'm going to hold you off until the end, because then we'll do the full round, and I'll give you a picture of what the discussion has been like. I'm going to be a little bit strict with all the sites. If you start to go over 3 minutes, I'll start to wave. If you go over 4 minutes, I'll probably be screaming, and by 5 minutes, you'll pull the plug.
Although I'm recording on the video camera
right now. Reporting that, what's been going on. We'll also come to Anna Karina, who'll tell us about the finish online discussion, and Matt is going to tell us about what's been happening on the English online discussion. So, to start with, in Cologne, and Dietrich, over to you. Yes, don't forget the ice cream.
Yes? The ice cream system. Send me a microphone. Yes, fine. We have started a global discussion with the question, how is knowledge created in the new network society? This is also the question which is posed at the beginning of the abstract of Stephen. Well, we have talked about a lot of questions. It seems to us that the whole knowledge creating and learning process is a process which, in Stephen's mind, goes on bottom up. That the expression of the network, where in democratic way, partners or people in the network create new knowledge. One of our questions was, do you know, do you need different didactical models to come up with the learning with the learning difficulties which people have, either by using networks, or do you tend to introduce only one didactical approach to the learning process? This is one question. The other question is, there is always different kind of people participating in a bottom-up process, either using network or not. So, isn't it naive to think that all people go from the same position? Do they have equal rights? Do they have equal intelligence? Do they have the same amount of good things or of being good? And what about censorship? What about propaganda? What about knowledge terrorism? And please think of the ideas which the Chinese government has concerning Wikipedia. These are all questions.
Thank you, sir. Ansel, can I go to you in Hungary?
Yes, sure. We have a short discussion here, and we've been discussing things about democracy and decentralized knowledge management, and basically we were talking about how it all comes down here at our university, how we handle e-learning courses, how we handle teaching materials, and also we have e-learning portals working here, so actually several e-learning portals, and we were discussing how they can learn more efficiently, how students can feel more at ease in these portals. And we also have preliminary questions, but we were discussing and we couldn't really settle it. What is the motivation? How can we motivate people in this institutionalized framework in a university or any other course, for example? Because we see that they are forced and they are willing to participate, but if this is a decentralized bottom-up initiative, then it's, at this time actually it's not something that is working perfectly so far. Thank you.
Thanks, Anton. Marcelina. In Poland. So, we've been having, during this lecture, we've been having severe problems with slides and with the voice. And finally, was connected with the viewing of the slides, and we were actually busy reading them. So, lots of discussion was quite limited, I'm sorry. So I'll give it on to another slide. Thank you. Okay, not to worry. Hopefully your comments can be reopened up in a few minutes for all of the time. Vladislav. In Slovakia?
Hello.
Slovakia.
Hello. I would like to sum up our discussion, which I would like to sum up into two groups. The one group of questions which we spoke about is going to do operative parts, which I do not want now to
turn
around. Another group was around the sequence of your products, which was mentioned in, on the slide, and I wasn't mentioned earlier, and we think that the knowledge is very tightly connected to his work, because it is already improved. In order to get new knowledge, they have to change the reference frame. And this is an idea which we would like to discuss about. Another question is about the technical issues. It means scoremanization or scoremanization. You know what I mean? It means you talk about the packaging, how it's connected to metadata, how it's partly connected to persons, and so on and so on. Anyway, since the is already going ahead, what's your opinion about the score, the future of the score? So to sum up, technical scorn and theoretical one, building and peace space in the center of the work. Thank you.
Thanks, Elena?
Yes, we have a very good discussion, and well, I think that the items that we discussed are very similar to the one of our colleagues over the whole Europe. The next one was about, let's say, the moment what we call the open educational resources, and how institutions like university, but not only university, could handle such a distributed and democratic model in a perspective in which normally content are built top down and not bottom up. And also there is another question about, let's say, the business model of universities. So I think we are at the moment in a bridge. We are trying to bridge the gap between distributed knowledge. And at the same time, we are trying to open our educational resources. This is a wave, it's an international one, let's say. But I don't think that university at the moment has a clear perspective of where they are going. So this is the main point of our discussion.
Thanks, Elena. Thomas, will summarize what we are doing.
Hello, it wasn't only about finding Waldo, I think it was about finding Nemo, because there was an ocean of issues around here. We have collected them in three major issues. The first one is that the focus of the presentation was mainly on the epistemology and theoretical foundations of your new concept of knowledge, and we were wondering what the consequences would be for a e-learning environment. What would be for teaching, well, how would the future learning, e-learning environment look like if you were to implement and translate your new concept of knowledge? That was the very first question. The second one was the introduced idea that this way of constructing knowledge, learning in networks or embedded in the networks, is really related to the area of informal learning. And we were emphasizing the tension between informal learning and formal learning, and what were the new concepts of knowledge would have place in more formal, institutional, organizational ways of learning. And then the last issue was the notion of a framework versus a network. One part of the group stressed the emphasis on that there's a need of a framework, a need of shared context in order to communicate. Without a shared context, it's very difficult to communicate. And on the other hand, it mentioned, would it be possible actually to start without a shared context, to start actually from failures like Wikipedia life, and then come step by step through a framework or actually share that. So the tension, do you need to have shared concepts in order to construct knowledge? These are the three main issues from Lewis.
Thanks, Tom. And as we know, perhaps you could tell us what the discussion has been like on the Finnish chat on.
Well, I must say that this discussion has been very, very wild and lively. We started from the patterns and the first question to be, are former patterns? The next question and then the discussion what we had was about the balance, how to balance teacher's role as a moderator, demonstrator in class, And now some of us refer to that the overload of information and patterns and networks all around us. And then we went to a very interesting discussion about teacher as an artist. Somebody was referring to art is the imposing of pattern of experience, and our aesthetic enjoyment is recognition of this pattern. Then the third question to be is evaluation of learning part of this work at all? Or is this learning about depending of the point of view? So we have some discussions related to, for example, what's going on in the outside world, what kind of patterns we have in our mind. Is that something which is always correct from the user of point of view?
Thanks, Andrea. Michael, what about your online version here? This part of the slow spot because of some technical problems, we had a quite lively discussion as well on the chat. And there were two main questions coming out of that. The first question is a philosophical one. It was, does knowledge exist without networking, without telling it to someone? And the second question was an ethical one, so I'm putting this chat here, which is somewhat different from the others. The ethical question was, will knowledge 2.0 decrease or increase the knowledge gap between the West and the Third World? So that were the main two.
Thank you very much, Michael. Stephen, that's quite a mix we have for you. What I suggest, if you don't mind, is that maybe just start taking them as they come, and if you want to obviously then engage, we are now open. If people want to interrupt or have something specifically they'd like to say, when you've had a chance to put forward your main talk, then we have an open discussion amongst all the sites. And remember, if you want attention, you start wave your hand
up,
you'll know that you want to
spend. Well, yeah. That's some pretty wide-ranging discussion, to be sure. A number of the points, it was raised in Germany, it was raised in Hungary, it was raised in Rome, was the whole tension between the picture that I'm presenting here and how this picture of knowledge is going to be used or going to resolve itself in an institutional setting like the university. Now, I've been asked in the past, on this side of the Atlantic, how I see these sorts of things impacting schools and impacting universities, and my answer has been, as often as not, that we will see the impact of this mostly outside of the institution. That my own observation is that the institution shows no particular inclination to change, and that consequently, the real learning that we see, the real development of knowledge that we see, will happen outside of those institutional boundaries. Jay Cross talks about informal learning. It was interesting that this informal learning was also mentioned. It was mentioned. Where was it? It was somewhere. And one of the figures that he comes up with is 80% of all learning is informal, 20% is formal. Although by contrast, we spend 80% of our resources on formal learning and 20% on informal. And it's this 80% of learning that's informal that is going to be most impacted. I honestly don't have a lot of faith in the ability of the university and other institutions to adapt
to distributed knowledge. You know, we look at phenomena like blogs and wikis and things like that, and the experience here has been, especially in the lower grades, like in the kindergarten, grade schools, the experience here is that they block them, they turn them off, they shut off access. There was legislation in the United States, it was called the Deletion of Online Predators Act. And the purpose of this legislation was to ensure that school children were not allowed to access sites like blogging sites or MySpace or any site where they could contribute content. Which of course simply breaks the network. The other side of this, and this came up, there's the question of, the need for different didactical models, if people have learning difficulties, and even how we motivate people in an institutionalized setting. It gives us different pictures of learning, different models of learning. I've tried to depict that in other areas. Instead of talking about learning resources, like books or exercises or stuff like that, we start talking about learning environments. And we've seen some of this discussion take place in the field of online games, and people like James Paul G and Clark Aldrich and others. And in the realm of online games, the idea here is that the learner is placed into an environment and learns through interacting with that environment. And the creation of the resources within the environment interact with different properties of the learner. So if the learner has particular learning needs, this becomes a feature of the learner in the environment, and then different aspects of the environment respond to the learner in different ways. I'm obviously being very general and hand-wavy, but the idea here is that because we're no longer dealing with resources, we don't need to talk about tailoring our resources to different models, different didactical models. We talk rather about the environment reacting in different ways to different people. And so I think we get even more personalized learning on this model. And again, I wish I could be more precise and not so hand-wavy, but I don't have a whole lot of time to discuss this. Do I want to keep going? Let me stop here and see if there's a reaction to that, what I've said so far.
Okay, perhaps we can just have up on screen that we can see your different sites. I think we've missed a couple of points there. In particular, they spoke specifically, I asked specifically about the formalization, in fact, of learning. Any comments on that?
And IEEE just announced a new thing where learning object metadata, that standard is going to be not fixed, but just slightly repaired, and I kind of roll my eyes. How to say this? SCORM, IMS, how do I want to say this? They're based on a broadcast model, they're based on a power model, they're based on a we know and you don't model. SCORM in particular is one learner at a time with no communication working his or her way through the training manual. And the reason why that has a future is because there are large organizations, such as the U.S. military, paying for it, and that ensures that it has a future. But I have commented in the past, more particularly about learning object metadata, but this overlaps into SCORM, that the specification was incorrectly defined from the start. For example, and I mentioned this in my talk, they talked about different types of resources, different technical properties of resources, say, and they try to lump all resources into the same sort of description. And they end up describing resources in terms of the program that you need in order to display the resource instead of in terms of any properties of the resource. And they haven't been able to grasp the idea that you need to describe different things in different ways, which means that your specification itself needs to be broken apart. The specification itself needs to be able to change according to the resources that it's talking about. And then, and again, I mentioned this in my talk, except for some very basic linking, which occurs first of all in content packaging, and then secondly in things like simple sequencing or learning design, the resources are not related to each other in any way. When I get a resource, for example, a learning object of some kind, and I look at it for the first time, I have no idea where it's been used. I have no idea how previous learners have reacted to this. Did they actually learn from this? I know very little about the history of this object, what context it's been used in, how long it has taken for people to use it in the past. All I have is the author's wild guess as to how many hours it will take. And so it seems to me that this kind of a description of a resource is an impoverished description. And because it is an impoverished description, it means that our resources are not going to have the properties that we would like them to have. And the property that we would like the resource to have is for the resource to be able to be presented to the learner in exactly the right circumstance. I talked a few moments ago about learning environments, like games. A game is one learning environment. A workplace is another learning environment. Electronic performance support system. A simulator is another environment. Think of any of these environments. When a learner is in an environment, they are doing something, and we want a resource, the correct resource, to be presented to them should they need it. And the only way to be able to do that is to get enough information about where the resource has been used in the past so that we can pick that right resource to put in that right place. And so until we get these kind of distributed descriptions of resources, we are not going to be able to build these dynamic, personalized, reactive environments that allow them to learn in a student-directed and in a, if you will, bottom-up sort of way. And so we'll have to keep using the traditional practice of directing the students. And as long as we're directing the student, we're increasing the probability that our direction is going to be inappropriate for that student's learning. So that's basically my take on SCORM.
Thank you. Just one that I'm following in whether that has any impact for you. You spoke specifically about the difficulties in motivating students. If the kind of resources that you have available to them in your portal have that kind of information, would that help you then?
Well, probably, yes. But that will be a long-term solution, and you have quite a long time of transition, I think, until we can get there. But it's a great idea and practical with you. Thank you.
Anybody else like to move to Stephen? Raise your hand and we'll go to the front. It's all about testing it, Stephen.
Yeah, let me address motivation briefly, because people talk about that. And to me, the question of motivation has always been the question of how to get somebody to do something they don't want to do. Because if they wanted to do it, there wouldn't be a motivational issue anymore. And so that means then that in issues of motivation, by definition, we're faced with people who don't want to do something. And I ask the question, why are we trying to force people to do what they don't want to do? The
the distributive nature of knowledge, the distributive nature of learning applies to the practice or the pedagogy as well, where the learning is intended to be directed by the learner rather than by some master who tells the learner to do what they don't want to do. And it seems to me that in this sort of, with this sort of approach, the question of motivation basically doesn't come up. But we don't need to worry about motivating the person. What we need to worry about is how to provide the person with the resources that they'll need in order to do what it is that they want to do. Now people say, well, gee, you can't just let people do whatever they want. But I see no evidence that tells me that you can't. I see no evidence that says, well, the vast majority of people will just sort of sit there and do nothing. They'll just twiddle their thumbs. I think that people, given the opportunity to pursue their own interests, will do so.
We had kind of a discussion related to the two that here in the
The question of our discussion, like if you want to impose, well, what to impose self-direction with the learners, what do you do is learn to ask the structure, to ask expertise on the motivation issue. And sorry, it's just personally.
So in terms of whether you actually can lead people to define themselves what it is that they want to learn, I think we'll hear a bit of an about the fact that there are still quite a number of subject areas where you need to have a strong evidence-based information and facts before you start.
Yeah, there was a discussion that you need to have a basic vocabulary, a shared concept in order to have a communication. So that was a question to work too.
Yeah, okay, we've got a bunch of things going on now. I'll take the easy one first. I mean, in cases where people ask for direction, ask for motivation, there's two types of those kinds of people. One type of people are asking for direction because that's all they've ever learned. They've been taught through their education to follow directions. They've been, their independence has been taught right out of them. They've learned to obey. And in that sort of situation, you're working now with a learner that has, in a sense, almost been deformed. And you want to slowly encourage such a person to take control of their own learning and to empower themselves. The other type of learner is one who genuinely needs some kind of direction. And in that case, when it's asked for, then it should be given to them. But the thing is, a learner who's asking for direction no longer has this sort of motivational problem. I draw the analogy of visiting Rome, because I visited Rome once, and I came out of the train station. I'm sort of looking around, and I'm in that square there, and I have no idea what to do. And I'm a tourist in Rome. I could either just choose for myself where I want to go, just wander around, and I did that sometimes, or I could get a personalized tour and hire somebody to show me to things, and I didn't have enough money to do that, so I didn't do that. Or I could just follow a preset curriculum by getting on one of those tour buses and driving around that. And I didn't want to do that either. So, but different people have different ways of seeing Rome. And the idea is, when the person comes out of that train station, you want to have the roads that they can walk on, you want to have the guided tour that they can take, and you want to have the personalized tour that they can take, and have all of these things ready in front of them, and then they can choose. And when they choose, if you choose to take a guided tour, then you're not so likely to be complaining that, oh, they're always telling us where to go, because that's what you chose. The hard one, the hard question, I kind of dodged it a bit earlier, but I do deal with that. This whole idea of having to have a shared understanding, and this really gets tricky when you have to have not simply a shared understanding, with, you know, not simply a shared vocabulary, because it never ends at shared vocabulary. Because once you say, oh yeah, you have to have a shared vocabulary, then you know, the foot's in the door, the camel's nose is in the tent. And people, well, not just a shared vocabulary, but you have to have a shared model of the world, a shared worldview, and then a shared set of values and principles. And, you know, so you know, eventually you're sharing the whole thing. But let's even just reduce the shared vocabulary. The inference here is that without a shared vocabulary, this is exactly what was said, without a shared vocabulary, you cannot communicate. And it seems to me that there is no evidence for that proposition. And in fact, there is evidence against that proposition. And I've tested this on a number of occasions, and I have the opportunity to go and to speak to people, and I put before them the word Paris. Well, we don't have Paris with us, which is too bad, kind of, because I like always using the word Paris. And I asked them to think in their mind of the word Paris. And then I asked them, well, what did you think? And lots of them thought of the city. Some of them thought of France. Some of them thought of the Eiffel Tower. Some of them thought of Plaster of Paris. And there's always the guy in the back of the room who thought of Paris Hilton. The thing is, you take one common word that everybody knows the meaning of, right? Paris, everybody knows what Paris means. And yet, when you look at the individuals, the meaning of that word is different for each person in the room. And the reason why the meaning of the word is different for each person in the room is because that concept, as I described earlier in the talk, is embedded in this network. And so it's linked and connected to different things. Paris might be connected to a city, might be connected to a person, might be connected to plaster, might be connected to Venezuela. Who knows? Right? And so there is no shared meaning of Paris. So how do we get by? How do we communicate? Well, very badly. A lot of our meaning is simply not understood. The possibility for mistaken communication is huge. Moreover, it's difficult, if not, you know, technically it's impossible to know when we've got it right and when we don't have it right. Which is why, I mean, this is why the theories like, Moore's theory of transactional distance and all of that comes into play, where you have to have the communication back and forth. Our communication is so unreliable when the teacher speaks to the student that you have to go back and forth. Hey, did you get it? Oh, I got it. Did you get it? Oh, you got it. Yeah, this is what I think I mean. But we actually have to test students to find out if they understood the very simple thing that we told them. So, you know, it's funny because, you know, Wittgenstein comes up with this private language argument. You cannot have a private language. And the reason why you cannot have a private language, he says, is because you could never know what a word means. Well, the flip side of that is you can never know what a word means. All of our languages are private languages. And we negotiate with a lot of uncertainty and a lot of guessing with the world around us, and that includes the language and the vocabulary of the world around us. So that's the reality that we're working with as teachers. And I think that when the teacher says something like, well, we need to establish a common ground, we need to establish some shared experiences or shared vocabulary, that they're actually fooling themselves, and that they're not really establishing a shared ground or a common vocabulary any more than when they say to the student, oh, let's make an agreement about how this class is conducted, da 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 da. It's not really an agreement, is it? It's the teacher imposing their vocabulary, their rules, their understanding, and hoping that the students will follow. That would be my take on that.
Thank you. Let's just start on the last slide. 46%. You buy that. Your participation in projects and activities, and the first thing we do is you sit down and say, you've got to define the terms here. We've got to come to an agreement. Do you agree with Stephen that it's a big waste of time? Elena, Rose?
Yes, I think that we do agree with Stephen. I think that we have seen to wander into a lot of different items. I think also that the role of teacher is very important. So I think that we still have to also to experiment much more. And to have a practical experience on this kind of item. Because I think that we have some hypotheses. We can look at the world outside university, but then we have in some way to find perhaps not this solution, but several solutions to different learners, formal, informal, and different learning environment also.
I think we have a lot of students in fact taking part this afternoon, and what Stephen is saying about these, you know, using your own analogy, the various different ways that students could be guided through their course of study. One is a very formal way, one is the informal way. If I could ask the students taking part today, how well do you think our universities are coping with providing you with those alternative ways of gathering the knowledge that you need as a result of the university experience? Is it getting any better? Are these informal networks being supported in universities? Anyone looking forward to that? In Germany, a couple of students there. How does the University of Köln do in terms of supporting your informal network-based learning? And we won't quote you, don't worry. If you're not a student, what about the two students beside this? Okay, not a lot of response there. Magdalena, what about the people around you? Anyone there studying? We'll give you a few minutes to talk.
Sure.
Not really wanting to share it off with us.
Yes. Now the situation is not so good, so I think it will be to see Roma in a real practice way, so we would like to experiment in the city and to try to collaborate with the people who works in university, so not the one studies, and to work with them to try to discover together our possibilities and try to find a way to get
okay, thank you. We have just a couple of minutes left with Stephen. Anyone else, we probably have a couple of questions when fully addressed. I'm thinking, for example, of that one that came in on one of the chat lines about the extent to which this kind of network-based learning, network-based knowledge, can contribute to a fair and more equitable society, the extent to which that extends or indeed decreases the bridge between north and south. Any thoughts on that, Stephen?
As always, I have many thoughts. we're always going to have these tensions. I described in my second last slide and in my last slide the properties of what I would consider successful networks. And I talked about disintermediation, I talked about distribution and that, and then the semantic condition, autonomy, diversity, and all of that. My belief is that if we constructed the networks that shape our world according to those principles, that the disparities that exist between the Western world and the rest of the world would be reduced. But my experience is that there is, if you will, an established interest for each one of these properties seeking to resist the development or resist the design of the networks in that way. The established interest might be interested in centralizing production in a certain place, or might be interested in ensuring that some voices are heard more loudly than other voices. Those sorts of things. And I won't go into all the details, but you sort of get the idea. So, I don't know how to phrase this. I wish I knew how to phrase this. I think that a network approach would result in a more equitable world, but I don't have a whole lot of faith in our existing power structures' inclination to lead us toward that more equitable world. I think there are just too many vested interests with too much entrenched powers to actually allow those who are less advantaged in our world to pull ahead. This is not simply a north-south thing. Even within our own societies, even within the society in Canada and within the societies in Europe, there are some people who are more advantaged, who have more privileges, and other people who are less advantaged. And, I think that were the networks designed in such a way that this imbalance also would be redressed. But we see, through the distribution of income, the distribution of bandwidth, all of that efforts to make sure that these imbalances remain. So I'm skeptical.
Thank you. Probably on a bit of a downfield at the end, but doesn't affect the rest of the calamity sensitive. Stephen, thank you very much. We're just coming to the end, and from all of the different sites here in Europe, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts and for leading us through a very interesting couple of hours. And we look forward to keeping up to date with your thoughts on all of the day. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Sorry, I didn't mean to be so short.
That's okay. I just didn't want to finish on the down note. It's getting better.
Okay, I mean our own small network we've established today, maybe we've started getting all that. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.